Your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
Welcome to Wednesday afternoon on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Coming up a little bit later in the program, the president is meeting with the video game industry today, talking about violence. We'll discuss that with CNET senior editor Ian Schur. Tired of waiting for those long freight trains to pass? Well, the freight industry is still big in Chicago. We'll talk about just how big in just a few minutes. But we start today with innovation in the XPRIZE. Have you heard of it? Emily Musil Church is the Director of Strategy and Impact for the Global Learning XPRIZE. She joins us now. Emily, welcome.
Hi. Happy to be here.
So I'm interested in this because I have to say I don't know too much about the XPRIZE, but from what I read about you, you sort of focus on the fact that we're in remarkable times and the fact that innovation, world change really is in the hands of each of us.
Absolutely.
Explain that for me.
So at XPRIZE, we're a nonprofit organization, and we design and operate large-scale incentivized competitions, and we try to get the world involved in solving grand challenges, and we believe that we can leverage the power of technology to solve the most pressing problems.
In a way that couldn't have been done 10 or 15 years ago.
Absolutely. This is about exponential change, radical breakthroughs, new technologies, and really saying, how can those be used? And we want to use the wisdom of the crowd to find out how those can best be used.
Do you think that people who don't focus on it or people who, you know, are living their everyday lives recognize just how different times are now? I mean, I talk to young people in business and about how when I was coming up, if you wanted a business, you would have to rent a store or you'd have to, you know, do all of these things. You couldn't do it from your basement or from your bedroom like you can now.
I think people do realize that we're living in extraordinary times. Some people are afraid of all the changes, but everyone is aware of that things are changing. We have powerful tools in our pockets with our phones and what we can do from our computers. So particularly young people, I think, are really harnessing this and realizing that they have so many options. But it's not just the young. We have people of all generations.
Right. I mean, is this like Industrial Revolution sort of era of change?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah. I think so. All right. So tell me about the different prizes. Now, you oversee global learning, but there are several of them.
Yes, we have 8 active XPRIZE competitions right now, and we're about to launch our 9th at South by Southwest on Monday. So tune in, or you can go to our website at XPRIZE.
You can do it right now. You can give us a little preview of it, Emily.
Well, it's going to be the ANA Avatar XPRIZE, so all the details will be revealed on Monday. So our founder and chair of the board, Peter Diamandis, will be announcing it Monday. But we can tell you that it's an Avatar XPRIZE with a $10 million prize purse.
So walk me through maybe not one by one, but each of these and how it works. And you talk about using the gaming industry or game technology and all of that for it.
Sure. So at XPRIZE, we have domains that we look at. So these can be things like civil society, learning and human potential, space and exploration. And we create roadmaps for the future and say, where do we need breakthroughs? And we talk to experts and people in all different fields to say, what is it that needs to really change here? When we launch a prize competition, it's gone through a process where we have 10 criteria. We have our whole ecosystem goes through and says, this is something that needs an XPRIZE, which means the market is not addressing this problem. The traditional problem solvers like government are either not willing or not able to solve this problem. So we say, that's when you need an XPRIZE to come in and make that change.
It's like a superhero.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's if something government can't do or business isn't doing, you sort of muster the world community to get it done.
Yeah. Well, then that means we all are the superheroes.
Yeah, well, I guess that's what we're talking about, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Because this can be anyone. We have people ranging from school children who teach themselves to code to solve literacy challenges in developing countries. We have baby boomers, people who are coming back to work with people to say we bringing all of our experience. People from all different countries. So every XPRIZE competition, we're having people from dozens of different countries around the world. This is certainly not just we are based in the U.S. We're based in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. But this is every competition is a global competition.
Okay. So what comes first, the competition or the problem? I mean, do you develop the competition around the problem?
Yes.
You do.
Yes. So we identify what is the major challenge. So something, for example, with the Global Learning X Prize, we have 250 million children around the world who still can't do basic reading, writing, or math. So we say, how are we going to reach these kids when we can't build enough schools, train enough teachers in time for the world population, which is very young?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we also say that there's a market here and it matters? So we have challenged the world to create open source software so it can be localized to different languages, cultural contexts, use the latest technologies such as artificial intelligence, you know, to be able to have these kids teach themselves to learn.
That's interesting. So actually, I just spent a week last week in Mexico, and part of it was working at an eye clinic and giving people eye tests and exams and fitting them with glasses that have been but I sort of gave the acuity test, you know, the big letter E on the top.
Right.
But we couldn't use letters because we couldn't rely on the fact that these, not just young kids, but older people, couldn't read the letters, didn't know the letters. So we were using like pictures of an apple or a square or things like that. How does the technology and the work at literacy get to places where the technology doesn't exist, right? How do you reach that?
Yeah. Well, so in global learning, we have tablets that were donated by Google. We're running a field test in Tanzania right now.
I was one of the kids I was with said, he told me in Spanish, he said, you know, I have a tablet. So they are there, yeah.
And we have solar charging stations. You mentioned adults. We have an adult literacy X Prize that's run here in the U.S. That's for phones that people already have, so technology for adults. So we're trying to say, you know, adults learn differently than children. Mm-hmm. So we really are, these are two different challenges that we're addressing in two different ways.
What's been the greatest success of these X Prizes?
I think the greatest success is that people are empowered to make change and to believe that it's not somebody else's problem to solve, that over and over we're seeing that solutions can come from anywhere. So we have, you know, we have a big poster in our office of a tattoo artist from Vegas who was one of the finalists in our ocean oil spill cleanup. We had high school students from Philadelphia who outperformed engineering companies in our Progressive Automotive X Prize. So I think that really, I mean, a lot of things go to market that aren't necessarily our prize purse winners.
Sure.
So we are getting all sorts of new developments in industries that aren't otherwise being
developed. So it's interesting to me, though, the greatest success you talk about is in the incentive in the beginning rather than the result in the end.
Yeah. So this is one of the powers of incentivized competition. So we can have a prize purse that's, say, $30 million, and then we've had teams raise $300 million collectively.
So you're talking to the Global Council of Council of Global Affairs.
Correct,
in
yeah.
Chicago,
mm-hmm.
while you're here. What
yes.
are you telling them?
So we're talking about today's International Women's Day.
Yes.
So the focus is on tech trailblazers and how we can get women and girls involved in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, and really to get them excited. So they tend to be very much underrepresented throughout the world, not just in our country. So that's something.
How does our country do comparatively? Are we ahead? Are we behind?
Well, it depends on
what we're looking at.
Yeah, who you're comparing us
right.
to. But the trend overall across the world here and everywhere else is that we don't have as many women involved. And the more we can say we need all minds, all different perspectives working to solve these challenges. And people, we live in a world that is very technological. People are going to have some understanding and engagement with technology and building and design.
So you oversee the Global Learning Prize. Where are we on the schedule there?
We will be awarding the last $10 million of that, which is a prize purse put up by Elon Musk, in 1 year. We've already given $5 million to our five finalist teams who are from around the world. And we are currently in the midst of a field test, a 15-month field test with 5,000 children in Tanzania.
And what does that mean? What's the...
So each solution is being tested in different sub-villages, and the children are – we did a baseline of what their literacy was and numeracy, and we are going to end-line test them in a year, and whichever has the greatest learning gains will – that software will get the $10 million prize purse. But again, it's open source, which means this technology will be available for anyone, anywhere. So we still – the next phase of it is all of you out there. Anyone who wants to, you know, have this open source software will have data from that. And we want the world to be engaged in making this something scalable for children everywhere.
Let's end this where we started it then, in the fact that anyone listening right now can change the world, right?
Absolutely.
We're at that point.
Yes. So just encourage everyone to not feel like the answers are coming from someone else.
Right.
If you have a great idea, don't assume somebody else is going to go do it. Go. You have the tools now. We have more power with our phones, with technology, sitting in your pocket, on your desktop. So go use those. Use your great ideas. Connect with people around the world. The answers are out there. We can solve the grand challenges we have before us. The future is beautiful.
Emily Church from the XPRIZE. It's great to talk to you. Thanks for coming in.
You as well. Thanks so much for having me.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
It is 12:52 here on 720 WGN. All right, let's talk trains a little bit, if you don't mind. On the phone line, Clayton Harris, the executive director of the Illinois Port District. And, I'm going to say he's fresh from Washington. We'll find out. Clayton, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Am I right? You were in Washington yesterday?
I'm still here. I'm in the airport right now, about to head back to Chicago.
Well, that's where I think a transportation guy should be. You should always be at an airport or train station or things like that. But it was rail day yesterday, right on Capitol Hill. And, you know, trains are one of those things that we think of when we have to wait for them, but I don't know about much otherwise. How significant is rail traffic, freight traffic in the Chicago area? I know it used to be huge. How is it today?
It's still huge, and the investment and the need for understanding and education on what freight rail really does and what it means to our economy is so important. So I really appreciate you having me on the show, and it highlights why we were out here in Washington, D.C., yesterday and today.
What are you out there in Washington talking about? I mean, is it infrastructure improvements? Is it regulation? Or what is it that they're after?
So the main three things that we looked at yesterday was basically the investment in the freight rail. Freight rail hauls about one-third of all U.S. exports. The short line tax credit. So there are such things as Class 1 railroads. Those are the big ones that you think about. CSX, BNSFS, CN and whatnot. And then there's also Class 2 and Class 3, and those are the short line railroads, and they really deal with commodities on the first mile and the last mile, getting them to the big boys, but getting them from where they need so that they can't be distributed out. So we looked at the short line tax credit as well.
So when it comes to what's hauled through Chicago or into and out of Chicago, is it mostly, is it coal, is it oil, or is it the sort of stuff that ends up getting picked up and delivered to us by the Amazon trucks?
You're talking all types of commodities, all types. So it depends on when and where, on what's going on, but it can be anything from steel, wood, lumber, to any of the other big box commodities as well, yes.
But mostly commodities, not the refined products so much.
Some of the refined products as well. I'm not sure what the percentage is on that, but you look at a lot of truck traffic that carries some of that as.
And how much of that is coming to us via water first? I mean, how active is the actual Port of Chicago?
Well, the Port of Chicago, thank you for that one, is really active. We're up about 16% from last year. We've reduced our debt by about 60%, and we're trying to encourage more commodities to come on the water. So the Illinois International Port District is a multimodal facility, so we deal with barge, ship, rail and truck traffic as well. So we try to deal with the interconnectivity of all commodities on all different modes of transportation.
How does it compare? I mean, is it still cheaper to ship something via a tanker truck or a ship through the Great Lakes than it would be to train it or to drive it? I mean, what are the cost comparisons there?
So on land, your cost comparison is going to be rail is going to be the better cost. Overall, barge traffic is going to be the cheapest way to send, but you start looking at logistics and timing on there. So whenever you're looking at moving commodities, you got to look at the between time and cost,
right?
And then the impact that it has on the environment, on interconnectivity with traffic, on what it causes for traffic or how it alleviates traffic.
We're talking to Clayton Harris, the 30s, the executive director of the Illinois Port District. All right, Clayton, you're running late for work and you're sitting behind a freight train. Do you ever swear at the train?
No, because when I see the trains going by, I recognize that that's stimulating our economy.
Well, I'm glad to have the time
how
to talk to you.
That's a good answer, huh?
That's a good answer. You know, maybe we can check in again. I know you guys have a railway conference coming up later this month?
Yes, there is one later on this month where the railroad executives will get together and talk about best practices, ways that they can impact the economy, the ways that they can deal with transportation, logistics in general. I mean, everyone's concerned about congestion and traffic. Everyone's concerned about the environment. So we're all just trying to get together and find the best way to mitigate all of those concerns.
All right, so we learned something today. The next time we're stopped by a freight train, we're going to thank them for the economy. Clayton Harris, the third executive director, Illinois Port District. Hey, listen, have a safe trip back, and I hope we can talk again soon.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Just let me know whenever you want to talk.
Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
It's 12:37 right now on this Wednesday afternoon in the Allstate Showcase studio. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. On the phone line, Ian Schurer, senior editor at CNET.com. Ian, oh my gosh, so many things to talk to you about today. Welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks. How you doing?
Good. You know, Kim Gordon in the news just talked about the fact, well, a couple of things the president's doing. One is the tariffs, but the other thing going on more immediately is this meeting with the video game industry, the Entertainment Software Association. And I guess he's targeted them, or he's talked about violent video games in the past as being a causation for school shootings or things like that. What's up with this meeting?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. This is actually what's happened is that President Trump, right after the shooting in Parkland, Florida, said that he was hearing more and more that people were saying violent video games is shaping young people's thoughts, is the quote. And so he then said that there was going to be a meeting at the White House, which is happening today in about 20 minutes or so. And it's going to involve some really interesting characters. Some of them are going to be from the video game industry, including the lobbying group that helped that's kind of set up to deal with Congress and lawmakers. On the other end, though, will be the Parents Television Council, which has been very critical of violent media, including movies, music, and video games, and a representative from Missouri who has also been that. So it's going to be a very interesting meeting, and I imagine somewhat contentious.
It makes sense, I guess, that if kids are growing up shooting things with their games, that they're going to be more sensitized or less desensitized when it comes to violence. Has there been any evidence that that's indeed the case?
Yeah, so there's actually been a bunch of research that the ESA points to, where there have not been any links found between violence in the real world and video game violence. And in fact, one of the common things I've heard from the ESA over the last few years is they point out that video games are sold around the world, and yet the United States is the place with the most violent problems. So the logic doesn't follow if you were to blame video games for causing
this. Well, that's
it
the
would
best
be happening everywhere else.
That's the best thing they've got going for them, if that's the case. I mean, if they, you know, if in Luxembourg they're playing Call of Duty or Call to Duty or whatever it's called, as much as we're playing it here, I don't know if that's the case. But so they got that. And then there was a law in California, right, that sort of banned violent games for kids, and the Supreme Court weighed in on that?
Yeah, so this was back in 2005 under Arnold Schwarzenegger, actually. There was a law passed that banned the sale of violent video games to anyone under 18 and also required some new packaging and stuff like that. And, the video game industry sued, went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, actually, Justice Scalia did a lot of research into this. And the ESA actually has some quotes they pulled from his decision, where he makes it very clear, not only was he not able to find research that supported the idea that violent video games affect young people, but in fact, he said the biggest problem is that it's running afoul of the First Amendment. You know, this stuff falls under First Amendment protections. You can't choose, pick and choose what you like and don't like to protect. So that was why the California law ended up getting struck down back in 2011.
Speaking of the First Amendment and school violence and all of that, there's a great story. I think it was written by Jessica Dulcourt at CNET, about, you know, sometimes you see someone who's tweeted something and you want to retweet it and say, look at this stupid, look how stupid this is. Look at this idiot, or look at how foul this is, or can you believe people right. believe this? But the part of the story is that when you retweet that in a way to demean them, you end up amplifying them.
Right, and it's a really interesting problem. So what happened was that, you know, the interesting thing about social media is that it, you know, the algorithms, these computer programs that control what goes in your newsfeed, they don't have politics to them, right? They're looking for the stuff that's most popular, and they want to put it in everyone's feed so they all respond to it. And so what's happened is the outrage industry, right, whether it's the Russian trolls that try to influence elections, or it's, you know, professional trolls here in the United States who try to get involved in politics, they've all learned that if you get people outraged and tweeting about you, you're going to get more attention. And so one of the arguments that came up in this story in CNET was, hey, you know, you can avoid this algorithm. You can beat the programs, and you can actually lessen the impact of these people by taking a screenshot instead of what you don't like and tweeting about that on your own.
So
and basically not using the tools that they give you to help amplify these messages.
So a couple of things then. One, if you retweet, and she points out in the story, there was a conspiracy theory about the Parkland shooting. Chelsea Clinton mm-hmm. and three other prominent people retweeted it as if to demean it. And through that, sort of that begat about 60% of all the mentions, the people who were opposed to it. So it spreads exactly. the message that way, right? But then the other thing is, the what people really want to do, the Russians, is to stir us up. Maybe not take one view or another, but just to tick us off. And that's what happens when we retweet this stuff.
Exactly. And it's worth noting that example from the Parkland thing. The tweet that Chelsea Clinton tweeted, so she has 2.2 million followers. The tweet that she retweeted only has 100,000 or so followers. So she extremely amplified it by tweeting to it and leaving a link to that original tweet that she didn't like. So it's very dangerous, particularly when you're a rather powerful tweeter, to do this type of stuff. But also just you and me, you know, when we are influential in our friend circles, which is something these programs decide whether or not we are, then we can also cause this stuff to get more right. and more noticed, and that's dangerous.
All right, so there's that. Before we go, I want to go to Arizona, and I want to get behind mm-hmm. the big rig of a semi-truck as it barrels down the interstate. Whoa, there's no driver sitting next to me. What's going on?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. Uber has moved beyond the testing phases of their long-haul trucking, and now they are actually doing real trucking. And the way it works is really interesting. So they're not bringing trucks into urban areas, right? They're not bringing them into cities. What they're doing is that you take a normal truck, you drive it out to, you know, out of a city, and then it's loaded onto an Uber self-driving truck that drives it across the state.
And,
the way,
but
and
Ian,
then it's picked up again.
So, Ian, so I drive the truck out of Tucson, and it's got gear for Sedona, say, and I take it to this transport station. They load it then on a driverless truck at a transport mm-hmm. station, and that driverless truck today is driving down the interstates of Arizona.
Yes, it is, and it's rather amazing that we've gotten this far this fast. It's worth noting there is a person in the cabin
okay.
in case things go wrong, but as we've learned with airplanes, you know, the last year was one of the safest years on record for airplanes. Part of the reason is that they're extremely automated these days, and we're just learning more and more that when computers take over, when the programming's good, when we're safe, all that stuff, it's better.
That's Ian Schur, an editor at CNET.com. Read a lot more from Ian and others at CNET.com. Ian, great to talk to you again. We'll do it again soon.
Definitely. Take care.
The Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Got a minute? Good, because I've got the Wintrust Minute, sharing the news and asking questions for small business owners. Unicorns are back in the news. One of the Chicago startup sweethearts, SMS Assist, is bringing in a former Amazon executive as their new chief product officer, Peter Commons. He worked to help launch the Kindle and eventually went on to lead Amazon's grocery delivery team. So what in the world will he be doing at a cloud-based property management resource company? Only time will tell. And on a global note, today is International Women's Day. You might be seeing a few efforts to promote awareness, and one of the common ways to show support is through the color purple. It's the official color of the day as we continue to combat and resolve women's issues around the world. But here in Chicago, there are numerous organizations to help champion women in business, such as the Women's Business Development Center, National Association of Women's Business Owners, and the Chicago Foundation for Women, just to name a few. So do yourself a favor and check these out. Tune in tomorrow for all of your up-to-date business news on WGN Radio.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
There are 129,700 to 30,000 people, I should say. Let's do that again. 129,730 people worth $50 million or more in the world. And one of them's on the phone line now, Elise Glink. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. I wish I was one of those. Maybe someday.
Would have been better if I could have done it with a little smoother read. I'm so sorry. Elise is the CEO of Best Money Moves, and you check that out at bestmoneymoves.com. But these numbers come from Barron's, right? 129,730. What's significant is that the number's going up.
Yeah, the number is going up. So the stock market went gangbusters over the last, I don't know how many months it is, about 14 months since Donald Trump has been in office. And there was a big, that gave a big boost to a lot of very wealthy people in terms of their net worth. But the economy is humming along as well. And we saw in this year's Knight Frank's wealth report that we've seen the number of people with a net worth of $50 million rise 10%. Which is big, mm-hmm. but we're also seeing just the number of demi-billionaires, people with a net worth of over $500 million, rose 11% over the last year. That's just stunning.
Good thing, bad thing?
You know, I think if everybody in the world was rising and we saw everybody move up a big step, I think I'd be a little bit less concerned, but is it really helpful that you've got maybe 120,000 people and they control $26.4 trillion, more than the entire, you know, U.S. economy? That's a lot of wealth concentrated in a very small amount of hands, and I'm not sure what that means long term.
Interesting, too, that there seemed to be a change at the number two position, right, where Asia has passed Europe when it comes to the number of these ultra-wealthy.
They have. I mean, North America is still the world's largest wealth hub, and we saw this week that Amazon's Jeff Bezos has taken over firmly as the leader in terms of being the wealthiest man in the world. He's worth $112 billion. And the talk now is how long will it take for somebody, an individual, to be worth $1 trillion? That's just a phenomenal right. amount of money, and it makes me laugh because 30 years ago, or 25 years ago, I was writing articles about, you know, what it would be like to have $1 million in the bank, and that seemed like a phenomenal amount of money. And today, by comparison, not so much.
Looks like the president is going to announce or sign his tariffs deal today, although the number of countries keeps getting smaller, so I don't really know exactly what's coming here. But that would tie into a sort of a warning or an advisory from a J.P. Morgan Chase executive that there could be big drops coming on Wall Street.
Yeah, so it was interesting. A top J.P. Morgan Chase executive, a guy named Daniel Pinto, he's a co-president of J.P. Morgan, said during an interview on Bloomberg Television today that he thinks that market gains are going to continue for another year or two, but he could see stocks falling 20 to 40% over the next couple of years and then maybe just sort of staying there where they were for a while. And if you think back 10 years or so, we had a period of years where the stock market really stayed within kind of this trading range. It would go up, it would go down, up and down. But he's thinking that there's going to be a very deep, steep dive and that investors are nervous.
Is he saying it's avoidable or unavoidable?
Well, he thinks that it's normal, and we've talked about this, Steve.
Right,
you know,
right.
It's normal to have a correction, right? And we had a very brief correction. I don't think it counts when the market plummeted, you know, 12%, but only lasted there for 2 weeks. So that's not a correction. A correction is supposed to be long enough to allow fundamentals to pull up. But what happens now with programmatic trading is that everybody's expectation is that things are going to bounce back very quickly, and so they do. And that it kind of negates the whole point of a correction. So he seems to think that that there could be a deep correction of between 20 and 40%, depending on where the market value is at the time the downturn starts. I think we're going to have to see some other things fall or get very unstable before that happens. So it could be another year or two of gains, so you don't want to dump out of the market now, but
right,
watch what you're doing.
Elise Glink, read more at bestmoneymoves.com, thinklink.com as well. Great to talk to you again. We'll do it again next week.
You sounds good. Thanks,
it's
Steve.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.